Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Finding your perfect home was hard. But thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Welcome to Jerusalem Unplugged, the only podcast dedicated to Jerusalem, its history, and its people. Your host, Roberto Mazza, will bring you guests discussing their relationship with the Holy City, a journey through history, society, feelings, and hopes for the future. Follow the podcast on all social media platforms at Jerusalem Unplugged.
Welcome to Jerusalem Unplugged, a podcast dedicated to Jerusalem, its history, and its people. I'm your host, Roberto Mazza, and today my guest is Dr. Eldad Brim. Eldad just got his PhD during the pandemic, which I think is a great achievement, from the University of Haifa, and his work is about the geopolitics of Jerusalem in the 20th century. But Eldad is also a tourist guide, and today we're going to talk about not just Jerusalem, its history, particularly the airport, who is an expert of, but we're also going to talk about tours in Jerusalem. We're going to look at locations, places, and who are the people going around the city. Eldad, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
First question, which is the same one I asked to all of my guests. Eldad, what is your Jerusalem? In other words, what is your connection with the city?
Well, on the most basic level, it's my address. It's the city I was born in and the only city I've ever lived in, apart from 2 years in the States as a young kid. This is the only city I've ever lived in and the only city I know, at least intimately. But it goes deeper than that. Jerusalem is not only my address, it's my vocation. You can say that my life revolves around the city. It's the city that I studied and the city that I convey to others through tours and through my scholarship. I wrote my PhD about a certain aspect of modern Jerusalem history. I spend most of my time in the city, and most of my friends and family are here. You know, on my father's side, I'm fourth generation in Jerusalem. My grandfather was an architect and an engineer who designed many listed buildings in British Mandate period. His brothers were also engineers and architects. So you can say that at least on my father's side, my identity is embedded into the fabric of the city. So it's more than just a collection of houses and neighborhoods and streets. It's a very big part of my identity for better and worse. Yeah.
Fascinating. Can I bring you back to a question of your family? You just mentioned your father, your uncle, if I understand correctly, they were engineers. So I was wondering what kind of buildings they engaged with.
Well, this is interesting. My great grandfather had 10 children and they were living in Budapest in Hungary. And they wanted to make Aliyah, to emigrate to what was then British Mandate Palestine, even before World War I. But then the war broke out and they remained in Budapest. They came only after the war when the British started the British Mandate. And they became, you know, laborers at first, but then they became professional builders, engineers, architects, some of them, not all of them. One of them was my grandfather, and he designed many residential and commercial buildings around the city. Some of them, as I mentioned, are listed to buildings for preservation, especially in Rehavia, some in Katamon, downtown, and some of the Haredi, ultra-Orthodox neighborhood. The big yeshiva, the big religious seminary on the Shabbat Square, at the junction in Masharim, and other buildings. He was also part of the team that worked on the design of St. Andrew's, Scottish Presbyterian Church, alongside his brother, a great contractor and engineer himself. They worked on the Barclays Bank that later became the Jerusalem Municipality Building. They designed it and built it. As laborers, they rebuilt the tower of the Augusta Victoria after it collapsed in the earthquake of 1927. They supplied marble to the King David Hotel, the YMCA. They even partook in the refurbishment or the renovation of the Al-Aqsa Mosque after the damage that was caused to it in the 1927 earthquake. So really, in many parts of the city, in many buildings, my family has a stake, you can say. And it makes me proud.
What you just said, it's unbelievable in terms of the connections with the work of many, not just scholars, but other individuals who are studying the city. Like there is a new project running in Manchester, in Liverpool, apologies, at the moment on the 1927 earthquake. So again, you can see the connections here, but also with materials and buildings, looking at who were the people, buildings, where the material came from. So it's fascinating eventually to put faces and names upon, you know, the people that actually built that modern Jerusalem. I want to ask you something just because it came to my mind right now. Good friend of mine, scholar, very famous scholar indeed, Yair Wallach, just wrote a book about Jerusalem in the late 19th century and moving into the early 20th century. And in a number of interviews, he suggested that the British essentially demodernized Jerusalem. By the beginning of the 20th century moving forwards, there were more newer buildings in Jerusalem than in New York as a result of late Ottoman constructions and then later on under the British. But then the British themselves sort of demodernized because they took away a lot of features, like not allowing a tram to be developed, sort of sanctifying the particularly the old city. I was wondering if you ever, you know, maybe in your family, if you ever looked at this kind of dichotomy, like modernization of a city, but at the same time, try to keep it like the sacred place. And I wonder also in your work as a tourist guide, if you ever feel this kind of a battle between the modern and the past.
Well, it is true. You know, we joke, we say that the 20th century in Jerusalem began in December of 1917 when the British arrived and they actually modernized the city. They built very little on their own, but they regulated construction and put it all in a legal framework and urban planning. They came up with five master plans for the city, which is pretty amazing. Over the span of 31 years, they came up with five plans. Since independence, we have only had one plan or two plans for the city. So they're, what they managed to do is remarkable. I don't agree with the claim that they demodernized the city. Well, they canceled the tram. I don't know if the tram would have happened anyway for other reasons. They turned Jerusalem into a modern city in terms of law enforcement, in terms of infrastructure, roads, water supply. They brought water. Water came to Jerusalem for the first time, not by gravity, under the British. The same goes for electricity and other utilities. So, well, I think it's really unfair towards the British to say that they demodernized the city. The city became the city we know, really, under the British. It is true that under the Turks in the late Ottoman period, the great European edifices were built, the great monasteries and churches. But that doesn't denote, in and of itself, that doesn't denote modernization. I do think that the British, if it wasn't for the British, we would still be a very much more primitive city than we eventually became.
This is certainly a very interesting debate. I mean, obviously, the question also, the sort of a colonial aspects in how the British rule. And as you mentioned, I think this is an important point. The fact that they introduce all of these rules and regulations and the various legal systems, And yet the buildings were a local product. I mean, Arabs and Jews with their own architecture, own ideas and possibilities in building the city. So again, it's very interesting to see how the city massively developed, certainly from the 1920s onwards.
But I will tell you this, Roberto, it is true that the British were against the industrialization of Jerusalem. That much is true. And they also tried not to allow for very tall buildings, which is still an ongoing debate in the city. And the most important thing, they came up with this regulation or rule that every building has to be built out of stone, or at least covered in stone. And that, you know, that it really is a demodernization of the feature of the city, of the visual aspect of the city, because it's very, we keep to this very traditional building material. And it's a big debate and argument until today. Should we do away with the stone regulation because it's very expensive to build like this? It takes longer. It does give the city a certain appeal and a certain look. Do we want to keep that look and appeal? That's an ongoing debate.
Yeah, that was like one aspect of my own work when I was looking at the early years of Ronald Stores as governor of Jerusalem. Lots of people, independently from their ethnic affiliations, religious beliefs, you know, Arabs and Jews, asking to build stuff with either corrugated iron or other materials. But the rule was that it must be the White Stone of Jerusalem, which was massively expensive, much more complicated to build. And in a sense, as you said, eventually that gave the character and the color of Jerusalem, because it's something that everybody driving, it doesn't matter which direction, but you drive into the city and all of a sudden you get to see all of this white. And obviously that's the result of basically urban planning. I mean, that's not an accident. Let me ask something about your PhD. So you're talking, in your work, you're talking about geopolitics of Jerusalem in the 20th century. Since you just finished, I mean, I'd be very happy to hear just a summary of your work. I'm very curious about it.
Well, the geopolitics of Jerusalem is a very big headline. It was much more concise than that. I was looking into those 19 years when Jerusalem was divided, 1948 and 1967. And surprisingly, not much scholarly work on a PhD level was done on Jerusalem in this period. I mean, I came across one PhD dissertation that was written as far back as 1973, the year I was born. So of course there was a great a gap and a great shortage of knowledge about those 19 years, which were crucial to the development of both sides of the city. I was looking into the Israeli side. And specifically, I was looking into how the city recovered the trauma of the 1948 war, how it was repopulated with thousands, tens of thousands of new residents, and the debate around that. Should we push more people into the city? Should we bring them there? Where should we place them in the city, you know, in a concentrated fashion or dispersed all over the urban area? It was a very great debate. And specifically, I was looking into the four stages during which the residents of the city, veteran and you, were housed. So first, they were housed in the former Palestinian neighborhoods, namely Katamon, Talbiya, Musra, and so on. The houses were there. Some of them were fully furnished, and they were just entering these houses, the new immigrants that came to the city and government clerks. And when that was done, when those were, you know, running out, you know, five Palestinian villages were annexed to the city. Shahbader, Lifta, Malha, and Karim, Dir Yassin, and one half of another village, Beit Safafa. So into those villages, apart from Beit Safafa, those villages were also deserted, and other immigrants settled in those villages. And that was a big challenge and not always a success. In the third stage, they had to build from scratch. All the houses that were already there were filled up. And for the first time, they built from the ground up. They built transit camps. We're talking about horrible places. You mentioned this before, where tents and shacks, very crowded, very poor, undeveloped, underdeveloped, hotbeds of political protest and resent and antagonism towards the state. So they set up a few of those camps. Actually, in my research, I discovered two more that actually no one knew about. And I found archival material about them. And those were, in the end, taken apart. In 1950, they started to build real houses, permanent housing, in new neighborhoods all over the city. And that great construction movement from 1950 until 1967 really shaped the geography of what we now know as West Jerusalem, this whole draw towards the south and to the west that was unheard of until 1948. Suddenly the city expanded in all directions, but especially to the south and to the west where there was available land and relatively far from the Jordanian border. So I was looking into how we got the city that was there on the eve of the 1967 war, its layout, its neighborhoods, its social or demographic cityscape, or the imprint on the city of the new neighborhoods and the way that the Palestinian neighborhoods were settled again with new immigrants. How we got the residential map on the eve of the 1967 war, which was the tipping point after which everything changed again, of course. So that was what I was looking into. Yeah.
Well, I hope it's going to be a book soon because, as you mentioned, there is not much written about Jerusalem, whether Israeli or Jordanian Jerusalem, between 48 and 67. And this is a massive gap. And unfortunately now, with the fact that the Jerusalem archives, the archives of the Jerusalem municipality are going to be moved and likely not to be made accessible, it's going to become even more complicated and hard to write that missing history. And you're right. I mean, this is like a crucial period. And I still have to find an answer to why historians did not engage in both sides, the East and the West, because the gap is equivalent. And it's not, I think, an issue of sources. I think it's more the question of a divided city and how do you discuss that, essentially. So,
The fact that it was a divided city only makes it more intriguing and more interesting. And yet, only little scholarly work was done about this. I mean, articles were written and a book came out from the Ben Tzvi Institute about almost 30 years ago now, chapters about Jerusalem in those, West Jerusalem in those years, and also about Jordanian Jerusalem, but all in all, not much was written. I think I know why, because, you know, when you look in a city which is so old and had such romantic periods in its history, like the Crusaders or the Mamluks or even the Ottoman Empire, to say nothing about biblical Jerusalem, ancient Jerusalem, these are periods that really ignite the imagination and spark your curiosity. Whereas those 19 years when the city was divided, I'm talking about living memory. I was born after, but my parents, their generation, they all remember those years. It was a small city. It was struggling. And above all, it was gray. It was bureaucratic. It was a government city. Not much was going on. It was really a struggling peripheral city. And that doesn't really ignite any scholarly desire to look into it. So it was uncharted waters in a way, and I dipped into these waters. On the Jordanian side, there is almost nothing written. Of course, there is the landmark book by Dr. Kimberly Katz that you hosted on one of your chapters, a very interesting chapter indeed. And she wrote about this, and she's writing more. I know there's another book now being written on Jordanian Jerusalem, and the man who's writing it is complaining. We're talking, he's complaining. There's very little to go by. Hardly, you know, personal accounts of people who used to live here, decision makers. Very little was written or preserved, and, you know, very little with which to work. And that is very, very frustrating indeed, because also on the Jordanian side, these were crucial years to the development of that part of the city.
Yeah, certainly the old city so some development changes throughout the Jordanian era, but they are forgotten in a sense, because again, there's not much writing about it, and even sources are hard to be found. Let me take you to another area of expertise. So you recently sent an article, which will be published soon, about the Jerusalem airport. The very first episode of this podcast, so Professor Salim Tamari talking about his childhood, and among his memories, there was this drive with his father from Ramallah to the old city of Jerusalem, passing by the airport. And he remembered the fascination looking at these planes, landing and departing, taking people in, taking people out to visit exotic destinations. Nowadays, there's not much left of what may have become the airport in Palestine. Today, basically, there's only like a shade of the infrastructure that was meant to become. And also the history of that place has kind of been forgotten and neglected. So can you tell us something about this airport? What's the history behind the airport and how did it work? And how eventually it was dismissed?
You know, it's a fascinating story that I came across purely by chance. I was asked a couple of years ago to contribute a chapter, a walking tour, an itinerary for a walking tour of downtown Jordanian Jerusalem, Salah ad-Din Street, Baba Zahra, that area. And I looked into old photographs. I'm not sure you came across the name of Apo bin Lian, who is an Armenian tour guide. And somehow he managed to amass and collate a great collection of black and white photographs of Jordanian Jerusalem, everyday scenes from the area of Salah ad-Din Street and the old city and all that area. And I was looking into these photographs, trying to come up with interesting places for my tour. And I couldn't help but notice how many travel agencies there were. And some had signs for various airlines that they were representing in the city, Western Airlines and Arab Airlines. And that got me thinking. And I started looking into the history of the airport, and very little was written. There was a great article in the Jerusalem Quarterly by Nahed Awad a few years ago. But other than that, very little was written indeed. It was, you know, piecing together small bits of information from here and there. And I managed to come across, well, I managed to author the history of the city, of the airport in its golden years, the golden age from 48 to 67. You know, the airport started in 1925 as a British military, mostly military airstrip, about 10 kilometers north of Jerusalem. But right after the 1948 war, when it came under Jordanian control, it was very important for King Abdullah to operate that airport and to bring tourists and pilgrims to earn legitimacy for his rule over the West Bank, which was not officially recognized almost by any country in the world. And I was amazed to discover that as early as 1949, flights started from that little airstrip to Amman, which is a very short flight. But by August 1949, and this is truly amazing, regular flights started to go from Jerusalem to Damascus. But that was only the beginning. And by 1967, over the years, some 15 different airlines, mostly Arab airlines, served that airport. It officially opened as the Jerusalem Airport in May 1950. And the terminal building that we know was built in 1955 or 56. The Jordanians tarmacked the runway and they had it extended once. They were about to extend it twice on the second time, but the 1967 war interrupted. But over the years, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of pilgrims, Muslim and Christian, and everyday tourists used that airport. It was the main entry point into Jerusalem and into Jordan in general. It was just another international airport, one more in Jordan, in Amman. In the mid-1960s, it saw half as many passengers as the Jerusalem airport. So it was the main entry point into Jordan in general. And we're talking about 15 different Arab airlines and at least one Cypriot airline. We're talking about destinations that extended from Rome. You could fly to Rome from Jerusalem, which was I was amazed to find out. Destinations across the Middle East, the Persian Gulf, and even Central Asia. I came across a report from the early 1950s, according to which there were flights from Jerusalem to Afghanistan, to Kabul, and to Kandahar. I was amazed to find this out. I don't know if it was a regular service or not, but we're talking about 16 weekly flights, 16 weekly flights, more than twice a day, you could go from Jerusalem to Beirut. Many flights to Cairo, Damascus, Baghdad, Doha in Qatar, Manama, Bahrain, Jeddah, Dahran in Saudi Arabia, Abadan in Iran, of course, a few domestic destinations within Jordan itself, Aqaba, Amman, Ma'an, if you wanted to go to Petra, Nicosia in Cyprus, and so on and so forth. And this was a crucial link between Jerusalem and the rest of the world, not for everyone, but for the elite. Kuwait City, where many Palestinians used to work as technicians, doctors, teachers, what have you. And it was really fascinating to find this out because, you know, some scholars would tell you that the airport only became international in 1965. Well, I found out it became international as early as 1949. And I was surprised to see just how many people used it and how many people came through. And it was really, if you zoom out, the one insight that comes from this story, Jerusalem used to be a part of the world, especially the Arab world. You could go directly from Jerusalem to various destinations around the Middle East, Persian Gulf. Today, Jerusalem is hardly part of the West Bank with the separation wall built around it. So it's like evolution in reverse. It would be from a small but very cosmopolitan city, it became a big but rather peripheral and provincial city today. It's a fascinating story. And you cannot disconnect the story of the airport from the tourism boom in what was Jordanian downtown of Jordanian Jerusalem. We're talking about dozens of hotels, dozens of travel agencies, money changers, restaurants, souvenir shops. Of course, it's intricately entwined with the story of the airport. You had 9 Western airlines that were represented in Jerusalem. A Scandinavian airline, SAS, had a representative resident in the airport. No Western airlines flew into Jerusalem airport. And we always used to think this was for political reasons because no country recognized Jordanian rule over the airport. But I found out that was not the case. You know, you had VIPs coming on official visits. The Belgian royal couple, the king and queen of Belgium, when they came to visit, they used the Jerusalem airport. When the U.S. Secretary of State, John F. Dulles, came to visit, he used that airport. And another American senator, Gillette, and others. When the Pope came, Paul VI, in January 1964, he came on an historic visit. He did not land in Jerusalem. He landed and then took off again from Amman. And this irked Jordanian officials. And they asked the Vatican, why don't you have your plane land in Jerusalem? And they were told it's not for political reasons, only for technical reasons. The runway is too short or too narrow. So it's interesting. The politics behind all this, because no Arab country ever recognized Jordan's rule over the airport, but still they sent their planes to land there. And I have a theory, it's also for political reasons. They wanted this foothold in the city and they wanted a stake in the city. So politics plays both ways. Of course, after 1967, Israel's attempts to make it again into an international airport were met with it didn't work out. No country would allow its planes to land there, and it was a great failure.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Yeah.
Yeah, the failure of post-1967 obviously is more determined by politics than anything else. You mentioned cosmopolitanism. You mentioned that Jerusalem was a cosmopolitan city. And this is the memory of a number of guests who lived in Jerusalem throughout the 50s and 60s. And they remember this idea of a Jerusalem filled with people, not just from other Arab countries, but also coming from the West and mingling with the locals and spending their money and going around the city, which is a rather different picture that you just mentioned from the contemporary, which is cosmopolitan, but up to a point, is much more homogeneous in that sense. Maybe the future will hold something different, but at the moment, this is Jerusalem.
If I can interject, is that okay that I interject?
Absolutely.
About the cosmopolitanism, Jordanian Jerusalem was a small and poor city of no more than 60,000 people, most of them quite poor, even hand-to-mouth kind of poverty. At the same time, it saw many more tourists than the Israeli side of the city, of course, and that led to a cosmopolitan air. And I found that during my little research, there were three dailies that were published in Jerusalem, in Jordanian Jerusalem, in English. Three English dailies. Today, there's not even one. There were three cinemas showing Hollywood pictures. Today, not even one. There used to be nightclubs in East Jerusalem. Alcohol was much easier to come by, I guess, than it is today. You had all these churches and all these Western organizations. You had the YMCA, the YWCA, just the amount of tourists coming through, pilgrims. If we were to take into account that Jordanian Jerusalem had about 50 hotels, then it's one hotel for every 1,200 residents. If we maintain the same ratio in Jerusalem today, we would have more than 800 hotels in the city. So it goes to show just how open to the world the city was. There was nightlife. Nightclubs, as I said. So it is very interesting because at the same time, it was a small, poor, provincial backwater. But, you know, at the same time, it was also quite cosmopolitan. So everything was more extreme. When it comes to provincialism, it was much more provincial than Jerusalem today. But when it comes to cosmopolitanism, again, it was much more cosmopolitan than the Jerusalem today. So it works in both directions, really. Fascinating. I never thought about it like this.
Well, it is indeed. And the more I piece together memories of people that lived around that period, you really get this picture. Obviously, the Jordanians had their own reasons to keep Jerusalem in a certain way because they had another capital, Amman, and political internal issues. And at the same time, Jerusalem was developing at this cosmopolitan filled with culture and richness, really, of people moving in and out. And so also contributing to the development of the local population, because obviously it's, you know, given or taken, I come and visit and I'll bring something. And, you know, that's part also of the economy of tourism, which brings me to the questions. How did you become a tourist guide?
You know, I spent two formative years in the States as a young kid, and that's where I got my English. And I managed to retain my English, and until a few years ago, even part of my accent, that's long gone, I think, but I managed to retain a vocabulary and a certain fluency. And friends and family who would come to the city, I would take them around because I also had a knack for history and geography, and I would explain stuff. And more than one and more than two said, why don't you make this into your job? Why don't you, you know, turn this into your profession, your vocation? And I decided I might as well. So I took the Israeli Ministry of Tourism tour guide course, which was fascinating. I do it all over again. The best lectures and, you know, tours around the country. I learned more in 2 years of tour guide school than I did in 8 years in university. I really learned to appreciate what this very small country has to offer. And I noticed that there was an inverse ratio between the size of the country and the amount of things to do and to know and to realize about this country. And every tour guide has an area or a subject that he specializes in. You cannot cover everything. Even in a country which is smaller than New Jersey, you cannot, you know, control and command knowledge of every place and every issue. There's just too much. So because I live in Jerusalem and it's my city and it's my passion in a way, I specialized in Jerusalem. And when there's no COVID, when there's no corona, it was okay. You know, many tourists coming through. I also work for Il Amim, which is an Israeli, a Jerusalem-based association, a political association, which, but what Il Amim does is to focus on Jerusalem in the context of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, trying to make accessible for many people as possible the issue of just how complicated the situation in Jerusalem is from a political standpoint. And I'm one of their veteran guides, taking tours around the city, taking groups, explaining about the geopolitics of the city, the situation, the separation barrier, Israeli policies regarding East Jerusalemites, their civilian status, all these things that make Jerusalem so volatile and so problematic. So I do that as well. So that's what I told you. Jerusalem is more than my address. It's my vocation. And as tour guide, I get to guide many people around the city, and I keep learning about the city and perfecting my knowledge, because you always have to, you know, be one step ahead with the new archaeological discoveries and whatnot. So it's fascinating, fascinating life, I have to say.
In an interview, you said, quote, "Mine is a Jerusalem stripped bare of cliche." I think this is an important statement, because there are so many cliche and stories that don't really fit history when we talk about Jerusalem. So I was wondering, as a tourist guide, what is that you include in your narratives? What is that you insist or highlight with the tourists that are walking with you through the city?
You know that about 1,000 years ago, there was an Arab Muslim historian and geographer who lived in the city, Al-Muqaddisi, meaning the Jerusalemite. I'm not sure about his real name. And he gave the most apt description, one-liner, for Jerusalem. He said, "Jerusalem is a bowl of gold filled with scorpions." And that is so true. And that holds true until today. This city is a cauldron of different religions and different ethnic groups and religious backgrounds. And the one thing that they have in common, all of them, is mutual hatred and resentment. And that makes Jerusalem a fascinating but very, very difficult place to live in and to understand and to make sense of. If you were to ask me 20 years ago about my relation to the city, 20, 30 years ago, I would tell you I love it. It's the greatest city in the world. But my love relations with the city soured over time. It became love and hate, a love-hate relationship, and sometimes only a hate-hate relationship. I don't love the city the way I used to. I'm much more cynical about it, much more cynical. That would be the word. Sometimes I lose hope when I see the poverty, when I see how decrepit the city has become, when I see the extreme politics of both Jews and Arabs, when I see the future, and I think it's very bleak indeed. And I'm not trying to make a rosy picture for tourists. When I take them around, I explain about the archaeology and all that, all the banal but fascinating facets of the city. But at the same time, I try to draw their attention to the current situation and to just how much of a tinderbox this city has become. And I'm not masking this. And I'm not masking my cynicism and sometimes my sense of despair and hopelessness regarding the city. I hope I'm not ruining your podcast by, you know, raining on your parade, but truth has to be told. It's not Chicago. It's a very difficult place indeed. And this is something you have to convey to your visitors. Otherwise, you're just not, I think, you're not doing your job properly. They have to leave the city, not only knowing about the Western Wall and the archaeology of the City of David and, you know, details about the Dome of the Rock, but also about what simmers beneath the surface and what makes the city so explosive. They should know about this. They should be aware about this. No visit to Jerusalem would be complete without this.
And yet you may have colleagues, and I know that for personal experience, who tend to paint different pictures. And I know this is maybe political in a sense, but a few times I took tours around the city, much more interested in the narratives, not in, you know, seeing places, but as an historian, I was interested in how certain locations were discussed, described, how the history of some places. And sometimes I had the feeling that, you know, some organizations, mainly like official organizations, they want to paint a picture of Jerusalem so that then the tourists go home, they can say, oh, I've been to this greatest place and the city is great and everything is fine. But it's not, and it's not true. I mean, there's a lot of problems as you alighted. And I had the sense that sometimes there is a way the tourist guides adopt to hide what you've just been describing, the poverty, the problems, the divisions. So I actually cherish the fact that you are honest. And I think this is exactly the point also of this podcast, to show Jerusalem how it is with the pros and cons. I mean, there's no city in the world without problems, and it would be a mistake just to paint this heavenly Jerusalem because it doesn't really exist in reality.
You know, it's very interesting what you say, because in 2006, I was very fortunate to have published an article called Politically Oriented Tourism in Jerusalem in Tourist Studies, I think University of Liverpool. And it's online, you can find it, I guess, there. Modesty aside, it was almost a groundbreaking article because no one ever came up with this term, politically oriented tourism, at least not regarding Jerusalem. And I managed to convey is that most tourists are not interested. Most tourists are everyday, run-of-the-mill tourists in package groups. They want to come and see the highlights and go home, and they'll be able to tell people, I've been to Jerusalem, I've been to the Western Wall and all that. It was great. Into the bazaar, I haggled. But there's a growing segment of visitors, Jews and non-Jews, who come not despite of the political problems, but because of them. They are drawn like a moth to the flame, and they come either to show support for the Jews or for the Palestinians, or just because they want to satiate to quench their thirst for knowledge and to satiate their curiosity about the political tensions in the city. It draws people. You have the same kind of tourism to Belfast, Sarajevo, Berlin before the wall came down. So it's nothing that we came up with, but I think we perfected the art of political tourism. And you have more and more people coming to like on our tours of Ir Amim, you know, at least one or two buses every week, every weekend, we go and discuss things that the normal tourist is not interested in seeing, even tries to avoid. So it's fascinating the way the politics became a tourism segment in its own right in this city, in this country in general, but especially in Jerusalem, which is the center point, the center of the fury, because Jerusalem is a microcosm of Israel. And that's the bad news, that in the future, all of Israel would look like Jerusalem. I think it's very bad news. That's where we're heading. So if you want to understand Israel outside the bubble, which is called Tel Aviv, if you really want to understand what makes Israel tick, and even tick like a bomb, come to Jerusalem. And we'll take you around and show you the relations between the ultra-Orthodox and the secular, between the Jews and the Arabs. Fascinating, disheartening, but important to see and to understand.
Let me ask you something personal. You just highlighted a lot of the challenges being a tourist guide in Jerusalem. What are the satisfactions? What are the positive sides of being a tourist guide in Jerusalem?
I'm glad you asked me this because there are positive sides. First of all, the great pride. Despite everything I said, I take great pride in the fact that I am a Jerusalemite, that I was born here, that I was raised and had most of my higher education in the city. I'm proud to live in the same city where the Dome of the Rock stands, Temple Mount, and the great archaeological discoveries, one of the oldest cities in the world, one of the most venerated. I'm not a religious man at all. And they asked me, how can you guide in a city which is based on religion when you yourself, you're a militant atheist? I tell people it only makes it easier because I treat all religions with the same amount of skepticism and cynicism. I'm not bigoted to one or other religion or, you know, religious notion or sect. I treat them all with the same, I don't want to say contempt, of course, but cynicism and a sense of criticism. That's the word I was looking for, criticism. So it makes it easier to guide people through the city and to look at all with a critical eye. And I'm very proud to have the Dome of the Rock in this city. I enjoy every time I go on Temple Mount, despite the tension, which is, you know, tangible. You can feel it in your mouth when you go on Temple Mount. But to point to the Dome of the Rock and to see the people melt in front of this magnificent monument and to explain the engineering of it and the history behind it, it gives me great pleasure and pride and joy. And then there are the smaller things, the food scene that we have in the city, the street food. This is one of the most delicious cities in the world. And I'm telling you this, and you come from Chicago, I mean, but still Jerusalem is a great culinary, a city for culinary delights, mostly Arab, Palestinian food, but also on the Jewish side, great place to wine and dine and to eat from the street, great street food, ethnical food. The versatility of the city, the fact that you can walk a few hundred meters in every direction and you're like in a different city altogether. The vast difference between the different neighborhoods, sometimes adjacent neighborhoods, makes for a fascinating tapestry or mosaic that I don't think is replicated in many cities in the world, including Chicago. So all this gives me great pride and joy in this city. And thank you for bringing this up because I usually forget how proud I should be. You know, I drown in my own cynicism and despair. So it's very nice that you brought it up. Thank you.
I must say that I'm a cynical historian too. I guess it grows with the years. The more you work on history, the more cynical you become. So I have sometimes to tell myself, oh, there must be something positive. And when I found it, I feel like much more relaxed and happy for what I'm doing. I want to ask you something. You just mentioned that, you know, the different neighborhoods in different areas of Jerusalem. Jerusalem is filled with borders. Some are international. They do exist as a line. Some other are natural hills, you know, different sides of a city, and others are understood, meaning that you know if you're walking into that neighborhood is an Orthodox Jewish neighborhood. If you're walking in another one, is a different kind of neighborhood with different rules and regulations. How do you negotiate this when you go around the city? How do you cross those borders? How do you feel crossing those borders?
Well, allow me to quote Yogi Berra, who said that in theory, there's no difference between theory and practice, but in practice, there is. So in theory, Jerusalem is an open city, and you can go almost anywhere you want, unhindered, go into any neighborhood. It's an open, democratic, egalitarian city. That's in theory. In practice, there are borders. Some of them are physical borders, like the separation barrier, which not many people know, not only encompasses the city north, east, and south, it sometimes enters the city, and a few Palestinian neighborhoods are left on the other side of it. In theory, you can go there. In practice, it's not that easy. Sometimes there are other physical barriers, like on holiday eves and Saturday nights or Friday nights, you can't go with your car down certain streets into religious neighborhoods. So these are physical barriers. Other barriers are barriers of fear, resent, and indifference. Many people wouldn't go to places which are fascinating simply because they're too scared. Sometimes their fear is justified, mostly it is not. Sometimes they don't go because of hatred. And sometimes they don't go places because they don't even know these places exist. And I'm talking about great locations around the city, especially around the Old City. In East Jerusalem, many Israeli Jews would not go there, would not venture into these areas, although they are perfectly safe, just because they know they are unwanted. And that breaks my heart. That really breaks my heart. So there are borders. The borders are especially between the Jews and the Arabs, but also between Jews and Jews. And I had the great misfortune a couple of times of taking visitors, Israelis and otherwise, to the very ultra-Orthodox neighborhoods, and we were pelted with rubbish or slander, you know, sometimes words and sometimes Coke cans were hurled at us. So these things do happen. It's a city where, much like Chicago, you know where you should go and you definitely know where you should not go. So it's always like we have this mental GPS in our head, and every Jerusalemite knows where he can go safely and where he would never venture into. And in that sense, Jerusalem, you know, which physically is the biggest city in the country, both in size and in population. But when you think about it, it's a collection of much smaller cities that, you know, you keep to your city and you hardly venture into the surrounding cities or towns around it because you know it might end badly. Yeah.
As a naive researcher in 2004, when I started my work on Jerusalem, I had to learn the geography. I understood that there was a geography, but at times I did mistakes. Obviously, I was not born there. I wasn't exactly aware of everything. But in time, I learned that. And I came to understand what it means to be a foreigner, white, male, Christian, mumbling both languages, so try to get away with things. And then I learned places that I could go, places that I should have avoided. And if accidentally I bump into, try to get my way out with some story justification. And you're right.
You know, every great city has this issue of mental maps. And research was done in New York, LA, I'm sure in Chicago as well as European cities, Southeast Asian cities. People were asked to draw, you know, residents of a certain city were asked to draw maps. And they came up with maps which reflect the places they feel comfortable going to, places they know about. And these are vastly different maps, you know, portraying what is essentially the same city. So, of course, if you give a Palestinian teenager a task to draw a map of the city, it would be very different to a map drawn by an ultra-Orthodox or by a secular Jew. Men and women would draw different maps. The secular and the religious would draw different maps altogether, the rich and the poor. That goes for every complex city in the world, but especially so in Jerusalem, I guess.
We're reaching the end of the interview, and I want to just come to full circle. So I want to ask you something related to the way you started, talking about Jerusalem as your address. You're a tourist guide, so you have your own favorite spots, I'm pretty sure. But in that brain, if you were to choose two spots in Jerusalem that you feel like these are your favorite places where you want to go alone, just to take a look at the view, to breathe, to relax, where would you go?
That is a complicated question because the list is rather long. It sounds banal, but it's true. I admire Temple Mount or the Haram Sharif for its history, for its architecture, for its splendid, splendid architecture. And I take great pride in that place. And I love guiding there and I love walking around. I'll never go there alone. I mean, I'll go there with tourists, And when I do, I just feel elated showing and explaining the Mamluk architecture and the splendor of the place. Another place I like very much is the plaza just outside the Damascus Gate. A very problematic place that saw many terror attacks in recent years, some deaths, Jews and Arab deaths. It's a tense place today. But at the same time, it's the interface between the old city and the new city. And it's a bottleneck. So many people would come through, Jews and Arabs. And just, you know, people watching, which is my favorite sport. Actually, the only sport I'm good at. That's the best place in the city to go people watching. Just sit there with something to eat, something you just bought from one of the vendors inside the old city, and just watch the gate itself. Just watching the gate is a splendid experience because you can just sit there and look at it the way you look at TV. But to see all this human traffic coming through, the Jews and the Arabs, the young and the old, it's a fascinating place indeed. Other favorite spots in the city, I guess, the Machne Yehuda market is the best market in the country. You know, hectic place. Very colorful, very delicious place indeed. Other great neighborhoods, Baka is a beautiful neighborhood with a very, painful history, but great architecture and great vibe, Bethlehem Road, all that area. So there's quite a few places. So it's important to, it's difficult to choose a few, but I gave you just a few, yeah.
You mentioned eating, so I must ask. Jerusalem food is very famous for being stuffed. What is your culinary experience of Jerusalem? What is your favorite Jerusalem dish, if you have any?
Oh, again, the list is endless because I'm a foodie and I eat a lot. And I have the good fortune of eating a lot in the different eateries in the old city because I guide there. So that's my excuse. It's part of the job. So I have to eat another hummus, another. But there's one hole in the wall. You know, these holes in the walls are the best. And there's one hole in the wall. I don't think it even has a name. And it dishes out the entrails. I'm talking about hearts, spleens, livers, brain, stuffed inside a pita bread with salad and some hot sauce. Not the most healthy food in the world, I know, but delicious. And to see the shock on the face of my tourists when I hand them, a sheep brain or a heart or a spleen or liver, they look shocked, but then they taste and it's really very good. The hummus next door is one of the best in the city. But every Jerusalemite, every Israeli will tell you, that's the best hummus I know. And I would diss out all the other hummus places. So I can, maybe I can end this interview with a little joke about Jerusalem hummus. There used to be one little alley in the old city which had four hummus places. And one had a big sign out saying the best hummus in the city. And the others had a much bigger sign with flashing lights and said the best hummus in the country. And the third one had even a bigger sign outside with many flashing lights, the best hummus in the world. And the fourth one had a small sign on the door saying the best hummus on this street.
This was Eldad Brin, a recent graduate from the University of Haifa with a PhD on the geopolitics of Jerusalem in the 20th century and a tourist guide of Jerusalem. Eldad, thank you.
Thank you for having me. Thank you so much. Pleasure.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news.
Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.